Okay, I went through these next four chapters, chapter five and chapter to chapter nine. That's what we have for today. That's a lot of material. And basically, he addresses the questions of the main themes of fear, violence, relationship, and freedom. Now that's a mouthful and a handful. You can imagine how are we going to bring them all together. Each of them is a world in itself. I mean, it would require a lot of inquiry to go into all that. Krishnamurti, of course, sees always the internal connections. As he always said, psychologically, all the problems are interrelated. And therefore, you can go from one to the other because it is a matter of they're all created by thought. So these are just manifestations of that fundamental operating system of thought that functions in duality. Essentially, it comes down to that. We might not even talk about fear or violence, but about duality in many ways, right? And yet, these are the phenomena in our lives, no? Fear, we all know it. So, in a way, also sometimes I feel that Krishnamurti is just pointing our attention, calling our attention to the fact that all these phenomena are kind of portals to the inner dimension of our own consciousness, to potentially perceiving the real structure that is behind them. We're busy with pleasure, with pain, and fear, but actually they're just produced by thought. But we don't see thought producing them. We just feel fear, feel pain, feel pleasure, and we don't understand the implications even of the fact that thought is creating all this. There are, the Buddhists said something like, our thoughts of yesterday create our life of today, make our life of today. Our thoughts of today make our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. So Krishnamurti is taking issue with this very movement of consciousness as abstraction, as the movement of time being the foundation of our life. I think that's where he sees the fundamental human issue, that it is this question of living in time that is the very basis of division, conflict, violence, sorrow, of our limitation of our own being, of the fragmentation of our own being and the wholeness of our relationships in our lives. So there is something there to consider as the more essential element that he always will come back to that. And therefore, the question of observation is also central because it is in the seeing or not seeing where freedom will come or not. This is a matter of seeing. We are in this state because we do not see. We do not comprehend the real nature of consciousness and how it tricks itself into how it deceives itself. We're deceiving ourselves, essentially, by living in this domain of abstraction, of self-centeredness, of division that the image necessarily creates. So that's a fundamental core, I think, of what Krishnamurti has to say. But then he picks one thing and another thing in order to say, all right, let's see if we can even comprehend or perceive the full phenomena of our lives as is happening in our daily lives. These are existential situations, existential phenomenon, which are not individual to you or me, but they are universal to everyone. We can say I'm an American or European or a communist or a capitalist or whatever it is that we are, Muslim or Christian or Jew, but at the end of the day, we're all in the same, psychologically, in exactly the same boat. These things become excuses, become escapes, as a matter of fact, from what we are. And this is a fundamental issue of Krishnamurti. What the teachings, he says, is a mirror of our human condition, not individually, but universally. What we human beings are behind the mask, behind the acquired identities, conditioning, content of consciousness, that the particular content is not the structure of consciousness. And we even have to go beyond that. Each particular identity will have its own particular image. but it's still an image. They're all images. That's what he's pointing to. And as long as we believe in the image, we'll be separate. We will be in conflict, sorrow. We will have no relationship. Boy, is that a horrifying perspective. But isn't that what's happening in one way or another in our lives? So let's go through these four aspects that Krishnamurti presents. The question of fear, of course, in a way, logically follows from our discussion on pleasure yesterday, because they are kind of like the two sides of the same coin. With pleasure, pain, and fear form a trinity, a trilogy of our psychology. Krishnamurti called them the three active principles of consciousness. Now, that gives them a lot of protagonism, doesn't it? That the three active principles of consciousness, pleasure, pain, and fear. He puts a lot of emphasis on fear for some reason. I used to wonder, why does he keep on going about fear? I mean, he comes and goes. But no, for him, it seems to be much more central. As though consciousness, in fact, at one point he said something to the effect that consciousness, the root of consciousness, is fear. Now, I'm still puzzling about that. And probably we might ask that question, you know, why would he go that far that the root of consciousness is fear? Now, fear, what is fear? Fear is feeling, an emotion, a reaction. Typically, you know, the actual word, interestingly enough, when you look it up in the English dictionary, and it gives you an etymology, a reference to Old English and Germanic, it comes from a Germanic stream of the languages, and it means means danger. The word itself has a root meaning, danger. So that is what fear is, really, in the animal world. It's a natural animal reaction. When we meet danger, face danger, the reaction is fear. And as everybody has said and knows by now, there are three other reactions within fear. The fight, freeze, and flight reactions. Those are reactions of fear, right? You're frozen, you fight, or you run away, right? So this is what we're doing in relation to so much, no? So you can see also, first of all, that violence would be part of fear. Is the fighting element, the defense, the protection, right? It's also the freezing. You just sort of we are paralyzed. So you're paralyzing and you run away. Fear is a movement of moving away from that which will be dangerous, right? So watch, this is at play in our lives on a daily basis. We become angry in self-defense, or we freeze in the face of attack, or we run away. It's very simple in a way. But it has massive consequences because it also depends on whether the danger is real or not. If thought is behind fear, then thought can create any phantom which will represent a danger. So we have to look into that. We may be afraid of nothing. Right? So we might be fighting our own shadow. We might be running from ourselves. And we might be frozen in ourselves, because we don't see that that danger is just a fiction, right? And that's what happens to many of us. We're just frozen, or we're just running away, or we're in a constant battle with that which we fear in ourselves, which is completely insane. So we see, fear is massive in its potential consequences, right? What do we fear? So we say we fear danger. We fear uncertainty. We fear loss. We fear pain. We fear violence because it causes pain. And yet fear is behind violence. Interesting. We fear all these kinds of things. But psychologically, which is where Kay wants to take it, because the animal has his own fears and has his own reactions and he will carry on. Kay used to describe, in fact, his own fear, biological fear, when he walked in the forest. And one time he saw a bear. Ran into a mother bear with its cubs. So you know what mother bears do when they have cubs and they meet Krishnamurti or any other stupid monkey coming into their forest. So there's Krishnamurti suddenly froze. Krishnamurti froze. But then in that frozenness, the bear realized there was no danger on his part. And so the bear stopped being afraid and therefore not violent, not defensive. And then Krishnamurti walked away. So, all right, but Krishnamurti had to freeze. Even Krishnamurti, even the Buddha, in the face of a, if he was the Buddha, in the face of danger, has to freeze or run or fight. So we're talking about something extremely natural, because it's a matter of biological intelligence, biological sensitivity, natural response. Now, when we look at ourselves and what we are afraid of, fear psychologically is a projection. Fundamental, isn't it? Is a projection into the future. So in fact, it's intimately bound to the future. It is what we hope for and might not happen, and what the danger that we probably meet and that is likely to happen is a probability and a danger, a threat to that which we hold dear, which we want, that we expect, right? So we are afraid of losing our security, essentially. My house, my little bank account, my wife, my books. I don't even want a fire to come into my house and burn my books. See what we're attached to. We're afraid to lose that which we're attached to, on which our happiness depends, and so on and so forth, right? That's mostly what we fear. That would be pain. And so on. We fear uncertainty. Okay, even defined it as fear is the movement between uncertainty and uncertainty. Okay? Well, fear is actually the projection of uncertainty, which threatens certainty. Okay? Now, one of the most fundamental fears for all of us is the fear of death. I don't know if we ever met it. See, it's so fundamental, right? I used to think it looks like it's almost inbuilt in the very nature of life. I can imagine the first little unicellular organism being afraid in this biological sense, because to live is to live dangerously. Life is dangerous. This is amazing, no? Danger is inbuilt in life. And therefore, if fear is the response to danger, fear is inbuilt in life. I don't know who would argue that way, but let's say that is how it's happening, right? Because it has to protect itself. And therefore, the self-protective mechanism is inbuilt in it. The amoeba doesn't have fear like us, not so panic fear or anything like that. But it will sort of still have a tremor somewhere when something that threatens its existence comes along. Now, that threat to existence is called death, right? So you say the fear of death is altogether natural. But Kay says, do you fear death? Or do you fear the idea of death? He is subtle, the old boy. Do we fear the actuality of death or the associations of the word death? Now, he says, you can only be afraid of what you know, not of what you don't know. We don't know death. So can we be afraid of it if he's right about this thing that we don't really fear the unknown? What we fear is to lose the known. We fear that what we don't know might threaten that which is what we call the unknown, will it be a threat to what we know, where we find our security. But this is very interesting. When considering whether fear in us psychologically is produced by the associations of the word death. Because if it's just produced by the word, then it's no real fear. And if death is there, we're also not afraid of it, because it's an act, it's a fact. So what's the source of fear? What's the ground of fear? See, he raises a very interesting question. Suddenly fear begins to lose its substance, its reality, its grip, because it's just produced by thought out of its own projections from the past, from his knowledge into the future by association. But none of that is actual. The actual is just the words that thought creates. Fear, that way, is a kind of hallucinatory process created by thought through association, identification of an entity as moving through that experience that is imaginary. Fear is imaginary. He will say even relationship is imaginary because we're basing each other it on images. We lead imaginary lives. When the reading today, I was coming across that, and suddenly I said, whoa, he's putting me on the spot. Oh boy, you are leading an imaginary life. You have imaginary pleasures, imaginary pains, imaginary fears, and you are yourself, as you think of yourself, just an imaginary entity. Can you be free from your images? And therefore, there might be the end of all that whole story. The story of fear, as he used to say, is very long. It has a long story, and we must be able to listen to it to the end. So he also talks about the inner story of the book of ourselves, of the book of humanity, that needs to be read. And of course, it's read in our daily lives. That's where it manifests itself. Fear, as he says, is always in relation to something. But actually, the something is in relation to, and the agent that is in relation to that object are both part of the imaginary process. It's like the dreamer who sees himself in his dream. I used to wonder, why do I see myself in my dreams? Which one is it? The one who is dreamt or the dreamer? The dreamer is the dream. The dreamed. That's why he says thought, which presents itself as the projector of fear, the perceiver of fear, is the creator of fear. So fear is the observer. The thinker is fear. I never understood this. He kept repeating this thing. The observer, the thinker is fear. I said, no way. But you can see why. Eh? At least I'm going to crack some of his statements and say, okay, what do you mean? the thinker, the observer is fear. Well, right, because it is the product of thought. It's just a projection of thought, which splits itself into this thinker and whatever it projects. And he says, that projection is not me. But it is me, because it is just thought. There's no observer and observed, thinker and thought. There's just thought. There's just the movement of thought. I find that very interesting if we can crack it that way, at least even intellectually, to come to that point of understanding such a statement. Because he puts it as, look, this is the key. Oh boy, if you get this one, you're free from fear. Now, would I not like that? To be free from fear, it's just such a shadow, has been such a shadow, chasing me all my life, for the love of Jesus or whoever, out. But he says, no, you cannot go anywhere with this, because it's in you, it's you, it's the history of mankind, it's the nature of consciousness. See why fear, consciousness is fear? Because it is in the very structure of thought, as he has developed, perhaps it's not inherent to thought to create this delusion of a separation between the observer and the observed, the thinker and the thought, therefore separating itself from fear, and then he thinks, I can do something about it. But you can't do anything about it because you are creating it. The management of fear may be necessary at certain points. If one's fear of the dark is becoming pathological, maybe you have to do some kind of therapy. Okay, you know, I'm not saying that, but we're talking about the essential element of consciousness in which fear is so deeply ingrained, has a very profound meaning, that has a profound implications. And Krishnamurti, actually, one of the beauties I find in this exploration is that Kay says this can be seen through. This is just the creation of thought. Fear is not the overwhelming thing it seems to be, though it is when it's happening. And you have to be fear. We have to learn to be fear. That's something else that's implied in what we are saying, right? To learn, to live, what he calls it, living with fear. But actually it means that if your thinker is the thought, if the one who's afraid is fear, then that means living with it, means being it. That our life is fear. That we, psychologically, as these separate entities that we have built up, are inherently afraid. Not just of death, not just of the denial, but of anything that seems to deny that entity in its time-bound becoming. We're all becoming. We all want to continue, which also is an extension, if you like, of the amoeba I mentioned at the beginning. The amoeba wants to continue. So we have translated it now into the psychological domain. So thought picks up that biological construct and projects it in time. And that's where we're stuck. That's why he said thought, fear is the product of thought. Fear, thought and time are the root of fear. So it takes that, and I want to touch on the four subjects, so I'm running a bit slow. So the whole thing of fear and conflict, you see, because he says fear, of course, one of the aspects is this quality of aggressiveness. See, violence is implied, as we said, right? I'm trying to make a connection, see if I can weave a little bit of a thread through the four subjects, which proved the challenge today. But there it is. One of the threads is that there's a connection between fear and violence, fear and aggression. The animal is aggressive. You see, the bear Krishnamurti met, the mother bear, was aggressive or was in an aggressive defensive positioning because he has something very precious to defend, right? Her cubs. And Krishnamurti was stepping into the area of danger, was an intruder into the safety zone. So that is part of aggression. The monkeys have it, we have it. Nationalism is just that, and all the other possessions and spaces we create ourselves for our security and becoming. The flags, the armies, all that massive construct of fear and violence. That's the structure of all those things. And it's institutionally embedded in society, right? We have to look at it in a grand way. We have to look at it in the full spectrum of how fear and violence go together and how they are so institutionally accepted by all of us. Why should we? Because that's us. And we don't see ourselves. And we don't see how we are the world and how we can change that world by dismantling the inner structure of fear and violence. Now, violence, of course, is very simple. No, it's not simple, sorry. But it is, in a way, just that reaction, right? From fear, protection, becoming, being something or the other. So violence can be, usually it was defined, used to be defined, right, in the dictionary as the excessive use of force. The excessive use of force. Now, okay, you may have to use force in certain situations. I used to be very careful not to use force, you see, when I was growing up. But I had an older brother, and he said, look, you're spending so much time with that. Just give it a kick. So I learned to give a kick when it was necessary, and it was not violence, right? Because I was afraid there was going to be violence, see? So no, right use, proportionate use of force in the right situation is not violence. We do have to use force. But there's the disproportion, and where does the disproportion come from, right? That would be a question. Now, Krishnamurti talks about anger, though. He wants to bring it home so that we can talk about war, right, and so on, which is a major issue, right? But it's just the violence. He says, war, what is war? War is the dramatic and bloody expression of daily life, right? So he brings it very close to home. It's just our own normal existence where all that spectacular, bloody, destructive phenomenon with all this tragedy, with all this suffering, untold suffering, that we continue to witness every day, by the way, in this monstrous way that we are, is still in our daily lives. That's where I see the connection, where I see my responsibility, and the possibility also that each and every one of us can do something about it. I may not be able, as an individual living in a particular country in a particular way, do anything about this specific conflict in a specific place between a group of people and another. But I have in myself the essence of that violence. And therefore, that's where I can work, where I can assume my full responsibility for everything that's happening in the world. What's happening in the grand scale is happening in a small scale, because it is just an expression of this self-centered movement of consciousness. That's the way to put it, right? So that violence is also me. See, that's, it always will come to the me, and the me is everyone. It comes back to me. So daily life, one of the expressions of violence in daily life is, of course, anger. Very simple, right? You get angry about anything. Irritation, upset. What did you say? What? I mean, you can see that the face already twists, even at the word anger. You know exactly what it means in a way, right? It's a bodily disposition. It's a defense. It's an attack. Something offends you, you get angry. And then we say this, that was righteous anger. I was right to be angry. Krishnamurti does not accept these distinctions between righteous anger and unrighteous anger. His anger is anger. And why is it there? What's the meaning of anger? What's the root of this aggressiveness? Because it's part of aggressiveness. And aggressiveness is, of course, an animal thing as well, right? So we have that biological component very much in us. But you can see that the part of the anger, what anger signifies, is there is some self-interest, primarily, which is being threatened. Again, it's the question of threat. Right? So it's part of fear, the whole element of fear. Now, this is playing out, of course, in daily life, like we say, and it is in relationship, because daily life is relationship. Now, that's where we're angry. We're angry even with ourselves. Why did I do that? What's stupid of me? And so on. And you can go back to memory and retrieve some of the even bigger blames in which to be angry about. People are angry about what's happening in the world. Some of my friends are very deeply angry about the situation, elections and all kinds of situations in which anger arises. Does anger, is anger the right response? And we say, yes, it is the right response because it's just so outrageous, totally, and so on. Righteous anger. We say this righteous. But what is the right response to these situations? That's another question we had to face because we are in that now. This is, like the Chinese said, we are living in interesting times in which there is all this confusion, these threats coming from everywhere to just simple, reasonable people who are trying to do their best. They see that the thing is degenerating into mindlessness, and that mindlessness, it only hits upon one thing, seems to be the way of mindlessness, which is conflict, antagonism, division, polarization, and conflict. It's the way of conflict. So it's the way of creating more and more threats to all of us. So people react with anger. But anger, is it the right response? Is the response of fear? And is fear the right response? Because this is an immediate issue. We have to face it by itself. We have to see through the stupidity, the ignorance that lies behind it. We might still suffer, though. But when you have immediate pain, there is not suffering. Suffering is also a projection of pain into the future. So to be so attentive, living with the facts in the moment, becomes an extraordinary discipline. That would be intelligence. You see, where would intelligence operate? This is another question. We have to bring intelligence to bear. Well, even we have to awaken it first, maybe. To awaken intelligence in such a way that we can meet every issue immediately. If time comes in as a reaction, thought comes in as a projection of fear, because we project fear. I already, in my description, describe some issues of fear. These people are going for polarization, which is going to create conflict. And that is going, if they have power, then that is going to result in oppression, injustice, and the rest. It might affect me directly or indirectly. I'm across the water, but hey, they're going to do some financial issues they're going to have economic consequences, military consequences, God knows what other consequences. Everything, the world is a whole network. There's no escaping it. What is done in Washington reaches my little town. Who cares? I said, who cares in principle? But there you are. We're stuck together. And therefore, that raises the question of responsibility. And if you react with anger or with fear, then that won't meet the challenge. The challenge is at a deeper level. In fact, we have to see about getting rid of anger altogether. Not getting rid, being free from anger altogether. Because somebody said something in this chapter about we have to understand. Do we see? That was the interesting. I have a son and a daughter. And he says, do you see? Well, I put myself in that position as being addressed directly by the old boy. Do you see that your violence, your anger, is killing your son? That's the last thing I would think about, right? My son just came today for tea. And my question was still fresh in my mind. How am I killing my son? It's horrible thought, even by itself. But you have to take it seriously in the sense of collectively, that's what we're doing. We're killing our children by sustaining the structure of violence in society, by maintaining these divisions of nationalism, of religion, race, and the rest. Violence is institutionalized. The most obvious evidence of that is that every country has an army. That's the institutionalization of violence at the core of the self-seeking security of society. And each of us is part of it. That army is a result of our daily lives. So the last thing I would want to do is to put my son and daughter in danger. And yet this is what society does. Not that I directly feel I'm doing that, but collectively, that's the actuality. We have a war in the making. Even here, peaceful, good old Europe, the great murderer, by the way, historically, but now at peace with itself because we've been intelligent enough to say no to nationalism and yes to federalism, which is incomplete. Everybody still wants to be French and German and English, of course. So there they go, the Brexit. We're not yet sane enough to really come together and be rid of the whole structure of violence. But also we have violent people around us to the east, and it's threatening. Threats, why are we threatening each other? See the question? It comes home indirectly. I cannot escape it, I'm in the middle. I'm living here in a swamp, but this swamp is part of a continent. And this continent has a certain political structure, economic structure, and there's somebody else on the border who says, no, I don't agree with that, or I want more land. Crazy. Why we are threatening each other and why nobody, or very few, these politicians don't talk this way, say, no, we have to work differently. We are one world. This is one earth, one humanity, one consciousness. Be done with it. No, they don't say that. They say, no, me, my country. Me, mine, me, me, mama, me, me. There we go. And therefore, all of us are under that threat. We have to rise also to that challenge. But anger won't do. Because anger is precisely what's in behind the violence and the fear. So we have to meet fear and anger and see if we can be free from it. Now, relationship is where it all plays out. This is all a matter of relationship. There's nothing but relationship. With things, with people, with ideas, the whole thing is there. Case, that statement of Case, it struck me as so simple that it might be missed, the implications, vast implications, right? That life is relationship. But do we have a relationship? If we don't, do we live? That's a bit the question, right? So he said, if we don't have a relationship, if what we said at the beginning, we relate through images. My image of myself and my image of you. And those two images have a relationship, but not us as human living human beings. Now, what else do we know? Is that not the relationships we generally have? And that goes for nations, goes for religions, goes for races, goes for everything. Everybody is functioning within the domain of an image, of a concept, of an abstraction with its particular content, which is always determined by the past. There is no image without a past, no identity without a past. There's no, being without a past, psychologically speaking, we are the past. This is also a tremendous thing. That's why Krishnamurti says, you know, freedom from the known is really true freedom. It's not freedom from something anymore, but it's from the whole structure of consciousness itself. Right? So what is relationship? Do we have it? If it is the image, then we don't have a relationship. The image implicitly divides. Why would it? Why is always an image divisive? Now, if I think I'm this and that, then I'm already creating a bubble. That becomes the observer. So I look at everything and I measure everything because the image as the me is also measuring, is continuously comparing, right? What's more, what's less, what fits into my scheme? You can see everybody's doing this. What fits into my scheme of things? That's what I value. That's what I love. See where love goes into that measuring of the self as to what fits into its schemes. You love yourself, essentially. That's where we're busy with. Kay even asked at the beginning of chapter five, I think it was, if you were to be asked what really is your deepest interest, what would you say? I said, you might say this or that, but if we were honest, wouldn't we have to say that we're just interested in ourselves? That self-interest is what rules this consciousness. And love becomes just an extension of that self-interest, what we call love. We want pleasure, we want security, we want to become somebody in society, right? So in this way, he said, you know, we're all, the parents feel responsible for their children, and they bring them up to fit into a society, which is essentially the extension of these values, of the self-interest that seeks to become, to achieve pleasure and become respectable bourgeois. Even when that far, the bourgeois, the respectable bourgeois. But that's not responsibility, because the respectable social bourgeois is the one that creates these divisions through the image and brings about conflict and war. And therefore, by being responsible for your children, you're leading them to war. So that is an extraordinary, I mean, sometimes Krishnamurti amazes me by the kind of overview that he takes of the causal system that is implied in what we seem to, you know, take for granted in our normal daily lives. The attachment to an idea, the dependence on a memory, the desire to be somebody, the continuous comparison between what is and what should be. We take it like it's just normal everyday life. It carries on. This is what we are. But it has massive consequences. The small thing that happens in your mind and in mine, in terms of feeling and thought, in terms of wanting and not wanting, in terms of desire and action, has world consequences. It is the world. It is what the world becomes. It organizes itself and it does all kinds of things and it pretends to be or not to be. But that is there. That's what the beauty of it. In terms of understanding that we, you and I are the world, each of us is the world, this is part of it. The exposure to the full spectrum of consciousness and its implications in each and every one of us as the key to understanding the world as a whole. See, that would be the response to all these things that are happening, right? Or anger or fear, but the understanding of anger and fear, the understanding of what we are in relationship, how we are ruled by images, how we are driven by greed, ambition, caught in jealousy, anger, aggression, fear, which deny love, as he says, right? We all want love, but we don't know what it means to love because we are loving within the spectrum of the image. And the image is not love because it divides. And where there's conflict, there's no love. He makes a dreadful diagnosis of our normal, ordinary human predicament. That's why he comes to the point of asking for freedom. What does it mean to be free? See, that's how I weave it. The fear, the violence, this is in relationship. We're not related. We are trapped in this structure of division and conflict that undermines and destroys love, which is what will save the world, like everybody says, right? Love is the great panacea. It will free us from everything. And you can see that even from this description, that would be right. Because love means there is no division. There's no separation between you and me. There is not this duality sustained in consciousness. And therefore, the implicit fear and rivalry and aggression between one person and another. So that would solve, wipe away the world phenomenon of violence and sorrow. He said those are the only two problems in human existence, violence and sorrow. Only two problems. We think we have many more. Economic problems, sexual problems, cultural problems. Well, there are only two, according to Kay. I thought I like that very much. I like to reduce the number if I can. There are only two. There's violence and sorrow, right? Violence produces sorrow, but of course, sorrow has also other things. Let's say that sorrow includes violence, but it goes beyond it. There's a little more to sorrow, right? It's the ending of somebody else's losing someone and so on. That's not necessarily the result of violence. So those two are the major issues. And freedom, as we said, the root meaning of freedom is also love. But what does it mean, therefore? And he brings the question of love to the field again. This is what he will always do. So we will have some repetition in what we're saying here, in what we're meeting here. And the challenge will always remain fundamental. He brings it to the question of perception. How do we see? How are we aware of something? Because he notices one simple thing, and we may have noticed this also, each and every one of us in our own lives, that when we see something completely, we are free from it. I like that a lot. I said, whoa, but it's a great challenge, because do we see anything completely? To be free from fear would mean to see it completely. Do we see? And he says even himself, one, fear has a long story to tell. Do we listen to it to the end? Or he uses another metaphor and says, fear is a tree with many branches and deep roots. Now, it's so deeply rooted that it's rooted at the very root of consciousness as we know it. So we would have to go to be free from fear. We would have to see through, have an insight into the root of consciousness. But can consciousness see itself? This is a question that I know Sri Krishnamurti answered very clearly. My feeling generally is that if consciousness is thought, and thought is the past, that it lacks self-awareness, that it is the past interfering in perception, in fact, that is the factor of misperception, of misunderstanding, of fragmentation. So we need a quality of perception in which thought, that's how he puts it, right? So he sometimes also asks the question, can thought be aware of itself? Bohm was going a lot that way by calling it proprioception. That the great part of our problems, I know it's sure of all, is that thought is just not aware of itself as it is functioning, right? That thought doesn't see what it does. It does something and says, I didn't do that. Like fear, right? Takes fear to be something independent of itself. There is a war and you say, they did it. And you don't realize that you did it. And so you fight the other poor guy, right? You are your own enemy, but you project that enmity onto someone else. Essentially, that's how it goes. See, we're all deceived in this dualistic movement of consciousness. If thought were aware of itself, that's the suggestion, it wouldn't do that. But he doesn't see it. He has almost an inbuilt blindness to its own operation. So he says, we have to come to the point of realizing that the interference of thought in perception is the factor of distortion, of not seeing anything as a whole. Fragments it necessarily because it's the past, and the past is inherently partial. It's blind to the fullness of anything, because it is yesterday and is not now. It is now, happening now, but it's yesterday. It's a very interesting issue to look into that, right? How the past, which is now, interferes with total perception of what is happening. But that's what it does. We can see this in our own prejudices, in our own ideas, all that is happening in our daily lives. We don't see anything completely. But that means also we don't see ourselves completely. We don't see the idea even that consciousness can be seen as a whole may be a challenging proposal. Very few people have ever even put that forward, as far as I'm concerned, that consciousness can be viewed, perceived as a whole. Through. It's a whole. It's something, therefore, that perception can see through and therefore see its truth, its relevance, right? Intelligence has to come in. And for Krishnamurti, intelligence is not of consciousness. Intelligence is outside the field of thought. It is intelligence that can see the whole. But the first thing it sees is that thought cannot see wholly, completely. So then thought, he says, suggests, if it sees that, if that perception comes across to thought, it can be still. And in that stillness, there is perception of the whole. In that perception of the whole, there is freedom. True freedom is not from something, but it is in itself. Because freedom, he put that extraordinary phrase there at the end of the last chapter, is beyond consciousness.